Okay, so this starts the regular meeting of the San Juan County Public Hospital District Number 1 Board Commissioners Meeting. It's Wednesday, February 26, 2020. It's a little after 5:30. We are at the Frank Wilson Memorial EMS Building. And if it's okay with everybody, I would ask that we can let Beth go first with her PIMC report. I believe she has classes and plenty of things to do and doesn't need to sit through all of our stuff. So is that okay with everyone? Okay. Welcome back.
If you want to do your consent agenda and that kind of thing.
No, that's okay.
I can be here till 6:30. So.
Go ahead. We're fine. We can.
Okay.
We can
just all right. Well, hi, everybody.
Hi.
I know everybody. I just met Kyle the other day, and I know everybody else, so hello. And
hello.
Here I am. With the every 6 month semi-annual report from the hospital, the Island. And I think you've all had a copy or some time to look through it.
Mm-hmm.
And as I usually do, this is on every 6 month reporting period. So you can see that the reporting period for this time is July 1st through December 31st of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
And generally it takes a month to close down all the finances and that kind of thing. So we usually report in February and August. Every 6 months. And I know it's a little hard to read, but we're getting down to where we're trying to cram all this, all these years consecutively on this one page, so it's kind of a snip thing, so I hope you can read it well. Since you're new, I'll give a chance for you to ask any kind of questions you want about these different categories and as I go through them. But normally what I normally do, this is the same report, same format, is I just kind of highlight what's new in this 6 months of reporting period from the time before. You can look at volumes and see track trends and that kind of thing with these lines of service. One of the prior commissioners had always asked for a percentage of zip codes, you know, who's coming to the hospital for services and where do they live. So I've always included that pie chart at the bottom about where the zip codes are. And, you know, 85% of the patients are from our hospital district. 7% are from zip codes outside of San Juan County, or are in San Juan County but off the island. So Orcas, Lopez, Shaw, Aldrin, all those zip codes. And then 8% from outside of the county. And it varies. It's pretty consistently these percentages. Sometimes outside of the county can grow a little bit over the summer months, usually that January, June, or July through December. It can vary, but it's pretty consistent. Any questions about the numbers of patients served? This is one of the categories of the subsidy agreement we're reporting on. It's clinic visits, emergency room visits, inpatients or observation patients, then all the imaging services that we provide for both inpatients and on an outpatient basis. So ultrasound, inpatient, outpatient. So these are, if it says inpatient, those patients that were in the hospital received those services, those x-ray services, or on an outpatient basis.
I'm sort of curious how those numbers are tracking over time. In terms of like the imaging or the total number of patients, is it going up or going down or is it pretty much staying constant?
Well, you got 5 years.
Yeah, you can see.
It's really,
it's growing.
You can see. I think inventory is
still
okay.
The front.
Oh, it's so tiny.
Yeah.
We're going to have to go landscape, not portrait, next time.
Maybe you should bring some
magnifying glasses.
Yeah. It has grown so much, and that's an amazing thing.
Oh, it is grown. Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's grown. It's grown over time. We started cracking in 2014. We don't have 2013, but we opened the hospital really basically right at the start of 2013.
Yeah.
Do you budget for these numbers, Beth?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Everything's budgeted to these numbers.
I mean, do you, in terms of forward thinking, you know, looking like in the next 6 months, do you take a percentage of expected growth and budget for that?
Sure. I mean, the budgeting process is annual. We just now finished it for next year. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to grow things like surgeries, outpatient, you know, procedures. When we first started budgeting, we can see, you know, with all this historical data that's here, you can pretty much put your budget towards that. When you meet with a budget guy, you can look back and say, oh, okay, well we maybe we anticipate more surgeries next quarter or next year. Maybe we add a surgeon. The GYN gal that's going to be coming, or that's starting up now, is wanting to do things like colposcopy and some of these other surgery things. She's getting capital equipment to do that. So you'll see some numbers go up, different things. If we got a different surgeon or a different line of service, or they'd want to do more ortho or something like that, we might anticipate those numbers based on what we have, and then we budget for that. Mm-hmm. But it's an annual process. Cancer care, I think I was explaining to Kyle and Annalisa the other day, is that cancer care, when we first started the hospital, we didn't really even know if we were going to use, how much we were going to use cancer care, and it's turned out to be one of the biggest service lines in the hospital, just because now they can do infusion of antibiotics and some other things that people need on the island. And so people have chosen sometimes to transfer things like some chemotherapies to the island instead of going off for those to Cancer Care Alliance. We don't do all the recipes of chemotherapy, but there, for some of the basic ones, we can provide that in cancer care. And then the last thing is this urgent walk-in. That basically the emergency department. We don't have an urgent care center or a designation. And I think the closest one is the one at Island Hospital. You can use your insurance benefit if you have urgent care benefits at an urgent care center, but we either provide primary care or we provide emergency care. So that basically covers us 24/7. We don't have an urgent walk-in clinic separately.
Okay, but it says urgent walk-in care.
It says that because those are emergency room visits that are lower acuity. Those are level one or two. For people that would normally go to like a walk-in clinic or come to the clinic, but the clinic's closed. So they have lower acuity pricing for those visits in our emergency department, so we track how many those are. And you'll see in 14, 15, and 16, we only provided that lower acuity care on Saturdays and Sundays, and it was confusing for the staff and everybody else, and they finally got it squared away so that they could bill for lower acuity 24/7. So then starting the latter part of 2016, it was available 24/7. Before, it was only available on Saturdays and Sundays. Because people were used to coming in on Saturdays and Sundays for like clinic care. And so people were used to that, and there was a lot of confusion about that. So that changed at the end of 2016, and you can see that varies. People now know they can see their provider. If they call first thing in the morning, there are open appointments in the clinic if they're already established with the clinic. But if they have to come in on a weekend or if they have to come in at night and it's just something like a turned ankle or something lower acuity, then it's billed under that category. That make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And initially, when you opened, you had care, primary care on the weekends.
Yeah, when we first opened, I don't know if you remember Dr. Wingren, but there were some physicians who agreed to work Saturday mornings, and that could happen again at some point. I've always maintained that we probably should have Saturday clinic on in the summers, you know, but we have to get physicians willing to do that as part of their contract. So right now, our physicians not only provide the primary care, but they also do the hospitalist work. So they have split shifts sometimes, and it doesn't always fit that they cover the clinic all the way, but we're recruiting for a new physician, and it's always possible when we get a new physician who doesn't really have a panel built up yet that they might want to provide those kinds of services, you know, particularly in places like the summer when it's light longer and people are doing things out in their garden and that kind of stuff. So I don't know that that's the case. You know, the clinic is managed by Peace Health Medical Group, not just the hospital. So the management structure is a little different. They have that. I don't call the shots for what happens in the clinic. That happens from Bellingham and that clinic structure. So they manage those physicians' contracts and figure out what kind of bases they need to cover.
Is it less expensive to go into the clinic on a weekend than to go into EMS for acuity care?
The
emergency department.
Yeah, it would be. You have to go on the weekend.
It would be. The difference would be we don't, we don't have full-service lab necessarily like we do. Like, you can walk out of an exam room on a Saturday or on a Monday and walk right into the lab. We have lab on call usually over the weekends, but that could be also, if we designated the hours that they would be open, we could have services available. So it's doable. It's all doable. We get the right staffing mix. Any other questions about volumes or service lines that are here, listed here? If you have questions later on, just give me a call. I'll find answers. If I don't have the answers, I'll find answers for you. On the second page, for the subsidy agreement, we usually report on the healthcare services that are provided, just a general bullet point of healthcare services that are provided in the hospital and the clinic. And we report on what the Peace Health Medical Group provides, which is the clinic services. And then, so I've listed those here. It's pretty obvious where emergency care is provided 24/7, 365. And I mentioned the low acuity walk-in is triaged at any time or day of the night. The same day appointments are available in the clinic. We have a huddle every morning at 9:30 at our emergency room board to say what's the status of the clinic. And when the phones go on right at 8 o'clock, they have 17 openings, and then half an hour later, there's three left, kind of thing. So it's people are now understanding to wait till the day of, if they especially have some sudden onset of something that comes on, to call that morning. Because they're held, they're not given out, everything's pre-scheduled, but we hold those open for same day. And the more doctors that are on that day, the more same days we have available. But each doctor has at least 6 to 10 patients they can see, or 6 patients each. And if there's 4 doctors, then you have that amount open. We're still a level 4 trauma center, and level 4 trauma center, and that means that we can only do so much trauma life support, and then we have to transfer patients to a higher level of care. We have behavioral health services in our emergency department and with our ED physicians, and we also have sexual assault nurse examiners that are available if that should come up in the ED. The primary care clinic, is managed by Peace Health Medical Group. They're open from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday, and they provide family medicine. There was one internal medicine, and we do have a pediatrician that comes once a month, Dr. Stephen Van. We'll name the doctors later if you aren't familiar with who they are. We do have Coumadin Clinic Monitoring, Diabetic Education, Integrated Behavioral Health, and telehealth specialty consults with cardiology now, and oncology, infectious disease, thinking of other ones, that just when they need a consult, we've got a telehealth network set up that those physicians from Bellingham can see patients if they don't come out for visits. We work with the public health department with their with immunizations, trying to promote increasing immunization rates. We've been doing that for a while. The vulnerable populations at home, we do have a home visit scheduled for our docs when there's patients that are frail and need appointments. That's been ongoing. We have case management out of the clinic for patients with high-risk chronic disease. They provide a follow-up and tracking on patients that have those problems and following up with them. We provide some blood pressure cuffs and glucometers, thermometers, anything that if somebody needs something at no cost, we'll provide it for them. And then most people get their results and do their corresponding with their physician through the My Peace Health portal. I'm sure you're probably all familiar with it. It works pretty easy that way. And now people can make their own appointments through this too. And so sometimes people get stuck and forget their password and that kind of thing, and I can help people navigate that when they can't get in there. Our integrated behavioral health services, we've been doing that for a couple of years. We provide a behavioral health consultant, and he works with patients out of primary care and our emergency department. I mentioned at the bottom here that we had telepsychiatry. We've enjoyed telepsychiatry out here since basically 2007, even in the old medical center. And we did that with a grant where we built the telehealth network and then contracted with the University of Washington back in 2013 to provide psychiatric consults, med consults, whereby the psychiatrist would meet with the patient for an hour, create the medical plan. It would be in our electronic medical record, and then our doctors would write the prescription and then follow up on patients if they had any problems with it, and then they would follow, you know, circle back with the psychiatrist if that was needed. That was every Tuesday for 4 hours, and we enjoyed that for a long time. And then at the end of September, University of Washington stopped the contract. They kind of redeployed their psychiatrist in other ways. And so we're working with them now on a new grant with Primera and the Ames Center at University of Washington that just started in January on integrated primary care and behavioral health, whereby we're still doing the same kind of thing where we'll assess people in the primary care clinic, but the consult with the psychiatrist may be a phone consult with between the two doctors, and then we need to find a referring physician and another telepsychiatrist consultant. And right now the Peace Health Medical Group has two in Ketchikan, Alaska that are getting their licenses in Washington State, and then they'll probably by April, I'm hoping by April, that they're back online and we get another 4 hours of psychiatry consult available on island by telehealth. It's really well received, so hopefully we can continue to do that because it's needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was surprised by the numbers previously of how many people are using that service, so it would be nice to get it online.
Yeah, we had, over just about 200 consults last year.
Yeah,
that's great. So, and it really saves a lot of time to travel and delays in care. Sometimes we'd be able to see the patient in the primary care clinic and get them in with a psychiatrist 2 hours later, which is unheard of access to psychiatrists anywhere. So we had a pretty good thing going there for a while. I hope to get that back. Visiting specialty is another thing. I'm sure you are probably aware that we have these specialties, OBGYN with Dr. Robert Kranz and Nadine Burrington-Foyce. They're out of Anacortes. They've been coming for years, and they continue to come twice a month. We have a GYN person that is new, Dr. Scanlon from Peace Health Medical Group, that will be hopefully doing these surgeries and starting those up pretty soon because she's coming out and does consults for just GYN right now, and she's once a month. We have our visiting cardiologist from Peace Health Medical Group. We have Dr. Raish every Monday in oncology. Dr. Olson, who is a private practitioner and from Bellingham, does ear, nose, and throat consults monthly. He's been doing that for years. He used to come to the old medical center, too. We have the pediatric consultant, Dr. Ban, every month on a Friday. And then something new that started this last year is that we have our chaplains who come out and they assist patients and families and our caregivers with any kind of spiritual or emotional needs they have. And they offer the non-judgmental and non-kind of religious-based care for spirituality. They provide individual counseling for patients. So if a patient does want to see them on an individual basis, all they have to do is let us know, and they document the chart, and they'll see patients that way. There's two chaplains, Barb Hogue and Jeff Packer, and they come out the first and third Monday of every month, and they're alternating the drop-in grief group every first and third Monday from 11 to 12, and it's really been well received. We have about five or six patients that are coming on a regular basis now, and they like the idea of being able to just drop in, and it's not a structured thing. They can come or they don't have to come, and that's been a really great thing for them. And for our staff. Our staff sometimes can debrief with them about things that come up, deaths or situations that happen. And so if you ever know of anyone that might want to see our chaplain, just let me know. I can let them know to call the patient. They usually call the patient themselves and make the appointments.
Beth, how, when you have these specialists visiting, how accessible are they? Are there appointments? I mean, if they're just out here once a month, do they fill up in advance? And so if they need to see somebody, it might be a while, several months before they can see them?
I don't know if it's several months, but it's generally a month. Because I know, like with Dr. Olson, he's usually full. And then some of these, you know, they, because of the location and they're here for the once a month, if they are, he will usually see anywhere from 20 to 30 patients. All of these providers will see quite a few patients. And, you know, if there's a hole in the schedule, it's rare. Because just being able to come to the hospital, to the location, to see the provider is a convenience for people that don't have to travel off island. We've, you know, we're working on dermatology. I know you know we are.
Yeah.
We work on that all the time, and podiatry, those two things. But if they're not willing to come out here and travel, and they're not within, even if they're not within the PCEL system, it's really hard. We've tried everyone, and they just are so busy in their own locations that coming out here is just one more thing for them to do, and
Marianne,
they haven't been
called
interested.
Called that a unicorn or something.
I thought about telepsychiatry, or teledermatology, too, and we've worked on that angle several times, and I've just recently been told again by University of Washington, not now, maybe later.
Okay.
So that was just off of last week. Outpatient surgical services. As you know, we do nothing but outpatient surgeries right now in our hospital. We don't have the ability to have a surgeon within 20 minutes of the hospital for emergency surgeries or surgeries that would require inpatient stays. We don't have anesthesiologists that stay out here, so we contract for those services too if they're needed during a GI procedure. But we do the orthopedic surgical consults, and we started out with just once a month with Dr. Kruzniak, and now he's every week doing consults 2 days and procedures 2 days a month. The gastro GI is Dr. Steiner, Dr. Woods, Peace Health Medical Group, and they do their procedures. I should have brought the calendar so I know how often they're here, but at least twice a month that they do those procedures. And then Dr. Michael Pietro is a general surgeon, and he does a variety of kind of general surgery type outpatient surgery.
So you can do a cholecystectomy here.
He did? I'm asking.
Yeah, can he did it?
Is it a laparoscopic?
Laparoscopic?
Yeah. Yeah, they can do laparoscopic stuff, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's done hernia repair that way, and I know the ortho guy's done laparoscopic stuff. Yeah, it says here, Gulp, he's done that.
That's great.
He's done that. Yeah. Nothing new. I asked if there was anything new he was doing, and there wasn't, so this is his general run-up of stuff that he does. But he'll come out, do the consult, and then schedule the procedure. So the newest thing that I have to report for this 6 months is that in October we got our new 3D mammo equipment, and I've and just in time for the National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And there's a little blurb here, this is kind of hard to read, but I kind of clipped it out of the marketing materials, but it's called the Genius 3D technology, and it offers a better, more accurate screening exam for women across all ages and breast densities. Imaging technologists can combine the exam with soft touch and smart curve technologies for greater comfort. The result is a clearer, more diagnostically accurate exam that leads to an earlier breast cancer detection. And I've had the procedure done, and it is not very painful. So it's a great technology for us, and I'm glad we got to upgrade to this. The forecast in fiscal year 22 is to start looking at upgrading our CT scanner and the digital X-ray so that it maintains state-of-the-art technology for the community. It seems like I'm just saying it's state-of-the-art, but it's really everything's now 7 years old. So anyway, our services, imaging services, are managed from Bellingham. The manager for diagnostic images is there. Our staff is available for regular x-rays 24/7. Mammos are every Tuesday, and we may even be adding another day for those. MRIs are twice a month. That's the MRI is the mobile MRI unit that comes out on Saturdays, and now that's twice a month. And that's scheduled ahead. Ultrasound, we have the ultrasound tech works 3 days a week. And she's not technically on call, but if they, I'll, as the administrator on call, if a patient comes in and needs an ultrasound, they call me, and she's able to come. If she's able to come in, then she'll do it. If she's off island or something like that, there's not an obligation that we have her come in. So that's available. We get the other DEXA scan, all the regular, all the usual imaging studies. Any questions about that so far? Okay. We have diagnostic medical lab, and I asked the staff to give me these blanks. So these are from their words. There's a lot of staff transition always in a hospital. People are doing things. We had Jackie Pittman, who was in the lab and was doing a great job in there, transferred over to become the supervisor of our registration staff. And so they found another person, and this woman's name is Susan, and she's really great with phlebotomy skills and working with the team. They work hard. They got to cover a lot of hours. They're on call for the emergency department. They do all the lab for the inpatients. They do all the lab for the clinic, and they do outside lab too. So they're busy, and you can see in the numbers that their numbers have really grown over time. They got a new chemistry analyzer during this period of time, and it's a part of a platform change that's system-wide in the hospitals. And they'll not change their test menu, but it brings a more intelligent middleware and auto-validation of results. That's live. They're going to be live in May 2020, and it will decrease the turnaround times in chemistry testing. Everything, space is such a premium there that they've had to have this machine in its being tested and going through its motions in one of the rooms, one of the inpatient rooms that's not being used right now. So they've been constantly doing that, and so they'll go live with that in May 2020. There's a lot of testing that needs to happen, calibration of these equipment to get it working right. Any questions about the lab services? Okay. Professional pharmacy services. You know that our local pharmacy, or our pharmacist is Catherine Scott, and she's been in the community a really long time. We're lucky to have her as our lead pharmacist, and we have pharmacy technicians recently retired, and so that's been a challenge. We've been looking for pharmacy techs. And really, the cost of living out here has been an issue with recruitment and retention. Everybody knows that story, but it's difficult. We almost had one, and then she decided it was too expensive to be out here. We have a technician that comes from Bellingham, and it's kind of temporary that she's hanging in there until we find somebody new. But there's always that. You get going, and then there's a staff change, and then there's recruitment and all those things that happen. She said that we are registered with the Washington State Department of Emergency Biologics, and we carry many vaccines and immune globulins that we pledge to share with other providers throughout the state if necessary. The pharmacy team supports the clinic, the cancer care center, the OR services, the inpatient emergency department. They do some of the mixes of their own chemotherapy there. It's quite an operation in the pharmacy, and they do a great job in there. Any questions about pharmacy? Okay. And then I always include our Peace Island volunteers because they're always up to something. And they had a PowerPoint that they did for our board meeting the other day, and I couldn't get it to go in there. But at another time, I will add it because some of their numbers are pretty amazing. They're their own 501c3. They used to be the old medical guild on the island for years and years. And they wanted to remain kind of independent, but they have their own money and they do their own thing, and they raise money for things like cancer care kits for new chemotherapy patients. They have what's called the Angel Fund, which I have used quite frequently for people in need, and it's kind of nice to be able to find housing for somebody for a few days, or buy somebody's prescription that couldn't afford it, or get them on a, you know, transportation, somebody drive somebody to Seattle and back, and be able to pay somebody from the Friends and Neighbors program or from the Family Resource Center to do that without having to go through Peace Health thing. So the volunteers have let me authorize up to $500 for anything medically necessary. So if I get a call from a doctor that says, you know, I've got a patient that's going to deliver and doesn't, can't stay in the hospital, you know, the hotel with her mom, and can we put her up, you know, then that's when I get involved with their Angel Fund. And their Angel Fund, they do specific fundraising for that, and it's been really a nice extra little thing to have in my social work belt, is to be able to provide that. And they do a great job. They get oriented, just had an orientation on Monday where they go through a kind of a site orientation of everything from the codes that they hear overhead to, you know, hand washing technique, confidentiality, and they, if they want to have badge access to the hospital to help out, they have to have background checks and go through that whole process. Any questions about them? We can't do without them. And then we're required to report on just the number and types of clinical physicians. So we start with primary care. All those names should look familiar to you. Dr. Rachel Bishop, Susan Mahoney, Lauren Olson, who we know will be leaving us at the end of next month, Ruth Fothergill, Mallory Brown, William Gunderson, and we are going to be interviewing a new physician to replace Dr. Olson next week, so I'm hoping that goes well. Because retention and recruitment for physicians is just as hard as it is for anybody else. So we really are hoping that, you know, location, location, location wins them over. Emergency department physicians, as you can see, there's a long list here. The ones that live on the island are Michael Sullivan, Jim Perez, and Carrie Matthews. And the other ones, Jason Heiner, he serves as our UW Medicine Residency Director, and then we have others that rotate through: Kevin Bowman, Jenna Lopez, Olivia Haysloop, Scott Schwitz, Allison Moyes, Mark Sarzicki, and Wade Hendricks. And they, we got to cover that 24/7, 365. So the shifts are 24-hour shifts. Dr. Jenna Lopez and Bowman will sometimes do a split shift, a 12-hour shift. But everybody else is really 24 hours in the ED. And then every summer, we're lucky enough to get two emergency medicine residents for the months of June, July, and August. Dr. Heiner has managed that program, and I haven't heard that we're not going to have residents this summer, but they come in really handy in the busy summer months. And they stay at our HEP house, and I don't know if you guys know about our HEP house, but it's staff housing just right up the street at 895 Spring Street, which has been really nice, that a lot of the staff that fly in and cover things like imaging and lab services, when they come from the mainland or they come from Bellingham, they spend the night there, and it makes it really easy for them. The surgical staff does the same thing. So it's really been a nice addition. Cancer care infusion services, just the newest thing is, well, it's not new. Dr. Raish still comes on Mondays, and he has a PA, or physician assistant, Kelly Cole, who comes once a month now. She used to do this on telehealth, but now she comes once a month and does follow-ups on survivorship appointments, which is really nice for her patients. Some of the new things that they've got going there, and just some bulleted points of things that happen there. They've got nutrition counseling available, and we still have the complementary services like massage and healing, or massage, basically right now, for oncology patients that want that, and that's covered by a grant. And then the other things that we're required to report on are the nature and results of quality initiatives, and there's two PowerPoints in there, and I don't know if you could open them up in your document, but I've also got the usual PowerPoint thing. The quality report is, you know, just to briefly go over this, it's kind of a lot of information, but we have a quality management system. We're required to have that for the hospital, and the quality plan describes our quality management system, and to achieve our safety objectives, the plan is outlined, it outlines the methods, the practices, and by which quality and performance are measured and monitored and analyzed. It's a monthly quality meeting that all the staff attends, lab, imaging, everyone, and then it's reported, the results of data reported every month, and then those reports are reported up to our community board, the community governing board, to drive accountability. We have a patient representative on on that board as well, so on the quality board, so he then listens to everything that happens there and asks questions that would be of interest to the community, and he brings a lot of perspective to that quality. Try to avoid the acronyms in that committee too, because there's a lot of them. And you know, like anything, our volumes really kind of skew some of this data overall, because they're one case can keep you from meeting your prospective quality measures. But the monitoring process and the outcome measures are including but not limited to these. And these bolded points shouldn't be unfamiliar: patient safety events, healthcare associated infections, falls in the hospital, hospital acquired pressure injuries, readmissions, the median time from ED arrival to transfer, the patient experience, inpatient overall nurse communication, patient experience with the medical practice overall, and outpatient diabetes measures and controls. So kind of standard for the clinics. And what I'm told is that in the next 6 to 8 months, we're going to be adding some subsequent quality measures, which are sepsis, readmissions, and mortality. And mortality, you know, one of the things that skews this number a lot in our measures is that people are allowed to have end-of-life care in the hospital, and so it's planned that they're going to go, and they're there with their families. And so anytime there's a death in the hospital, it shows up on this mortality like it's an alarming thing, but it's not. It's something we know about, it's something we measure, and it really is a gift to the community. Just overall, you know, you can see this PowerPoint for yourself. Just the clinical excellence initiatives include all these same things: the catheter-associated urinary tract. We're at zero always. We always have been in this data, and it's we have been recognized for some of this in the whole system, because we, for one, we don't have the volume, so that probably is one reason why we aren't seeing more of these. But when we don't have that many people to take care of, we take good care of them. And then the last thing is regulatory. Of course, you know, we're regulated by all kinds of agencies. And we, at the, so the last half of 2019, there were no additional visits from regulatory agencies, but they come generally in May, and we're due for our surveyors from the DMV. The annual survey is in the next 3 months. So we're preparing for that. That's when the surveyors come out and look at everything to make sure you're up to speed, no outdated medications, everything, policies and procedures in place, all those things. So it's you really have to perform for them, because they are there for about 3 days, and the focus is on improving quality. So that's the good thing about the surveys. You learn a lot, and you learn where you're doing a good job and where you're not. Any questions about the quality report or PowerPoint? If you have other questions, specific questions that I can have somebody else in the department answer, I'm happy to. And then the patient experience indicators, all this data is generated from the patient surveys. And I'm sure you've heard that the patient surveys are long and arduous, and people don't like to fill them out. And I've gotten them myself, and I wholeheartedly agree. But that's the only way that we can provide some of this data and get some of this information. These experience scores are from results from this reporting period through the end of July 1st through December 31st. And they measure things through fiscal years and calendar years, so you'll see some of those categories there. But, you know, the end number is small for some of these results. Like, you'll see that number underneath these colors, you know, 11. That means 11 people really did a survey in these areas for the hospital and stays. And then down at the bottom here, emergency department overall, there's like 209, 262, 263 people. A lot of our inpatients that are in are elderly and probably don't even want to fill out those surveys, and sometimes their families do. And then it's broken down under emergency department review, inpatient experience overview, and like in the inpatient experience overview, it's marked that the biggest challenge is in improving the care experience for admitted patients is that we don't have a large enough admitted patient volume to be able to adequately measure how we're doing at providing care to our admitted patients. Between this period, we only received 7 inpatient surveys, and we need at least 30 to make statistical valid data. But you can see we still learn from the surveys that are returned. And then the last category is the outpatient surgery overview. And it shows opportunities for improvement. But still, we rank, the discharge score is 96.7% is higher than percentile rank. This is a lot of data. And the woman that puts this together, Jenny Westbury, if you have specific questions for her, she's really the one that could answer a lot of these questions because she gathers this data for all the system networks and for us. And she's pretty good at explaining a lot of this data. And we hear the patient experience scores at all the quality meetings and also at the board meetings, community board meetings. Any questions about any of that?
Got a couple. Okay. Were there no negative comments? Just saying, yeah, these
are
positive comments. That's great.
She's had it in the past.
Yeah, I think very positive. So that's good feedback.
I haven't seen any. I mean, she's had it in the past. These are patient accounts. And these are from usually emergency room visits and inpatient visits. These come off the surveys.
And then is there some sort of cheat sheet that explains some of the terminology? I'm thinking of that, the first primary slide. It's pretty opaque to me. You know, like I don't know what a bedside shift report, top box score, and that was one of the easier ones, I think. Mm-hmm. HCAHPS, recommend hospital top box score. I just don't know what any of those terms mean.
Yeah, it's a healthcare. I'll have to get it for you because it's I'm so used to just saying HCAHPS on this.
No,
it's
and I'm sure there's an explanation.
but
I don't know what any of these terms
are. I told Jenny when she said, I said, I wish you'd come and just say all this stuff because this is your ball of wax. But yeah, I mean, things like communication with the nurses is pretty straightforward. Responsiveness of the staff.
That actually isn't, I'm sorry, I don't see that as necessarily straightforward. Does that mean that they had communication or they had positive communication or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's...
I don't, like, it's just a number next to it. So
yeah, there's a bunch of...
What does it mean to be 90.7% communication with nurses?
Right. There's...
I'm sorry, I'm not
there's a bunch of questions that are under that category. Like, did your nurse say this? Did your nurse say that? So it's not just one question. It's like 7 questions. It's a good thing. I'll get them to you guys.
That'd be great.
They're very interesting.
Yeah, have you seen them? I know.
Oh,
like,
all the time. In
it's
fact,
like a 10,
I
it's like
used
a 14
to deliver care in home health. I would use that survey very specifically because that's what people were going to be mailed and going to be asked. Because I'm not a big press gainy survey
fan. I
know.
Fan.
They're a pain in the patootie. However, it's the system that we're all mostly using.
I know.
And so I would use that to assure that I was meeting those standards in the care I was delivering. So,
yeah,
I think it'd be great for everybody to see have one of those.
Yes,
I
will
yes
get
or
you
no,
guys.
Oh,
they're scale,
they're complicated. Page. I've helped patients actually, well, friends fill them out. You know, who are like, I don't know where to start.
How confident are we in that part right now?
Yeah, and there's the on page 4, there's that inpatient experience overview. And it says, so the two areas, the only two areas I see that are not really high are the communication about pain. It just says never 50% or always 50%. So, in that little orange box. And then care transitions, whatever that is that leaving the hospital or being discharged?
Yeah, discharge information, care transition.
Seems to be more always all seem to be favorable. So that would be interesting to know what those questions are. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll get them for you because they are. And, you know, a lot of people misunderstand, like, the rounding the, from your an executive or something. You know, with the pharmacist is actually the most prominent person to go in and round with everybody up on their discharge. You know, do you understand your medications and all of that? And she would be one of the people that would qualify as this, but people don't see it that way as, oh, that's not an administrator coming in to see me. This is, she is at an admin level. If they said, yes, I got all this stuff done, they can check the mark. But yeah, I'll get this. I'll get a copy of the surveys for you and maybe an overview from Jenny so that it's kind of user-friendly so that you can see what this is, because it is, it's almost 14 pages long, and it just goes on and
so
on, and people kind of give up after a while after answering these things.
Yes.
But it is, it does drive all the data that you've got to have to get to from point A to B. So I'll have Jenny get me that too, and then I'll just email it out to Nathan and send it to you guys. Does that sound okay? Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I could probably manage that.
Yeah. Okay. And so the last part is the financial viability of the operation. We're required to do that and give you these numbers. And again, this is for a 6-month reporting period. If you look at this page, the very top line where it says, you got
it. It's in that first packet.
Very end of that.
It's like a financial page.
Numbers on it.
Before these.
We jumped around.
Okay. So this is a 6-month snapshot of the finances, and basically, as the subsidy spells out, there are two service lines, emergency department and family practice. When you start at the top line, that 511,294, that's the tax monies that the district hopefully will release to the hospital for that 6 months of time, because then you can see the consequences if it isn't or if it is. These are the two service lines, which is revenue, expenses, and deductions. And deductions, which would be Medicare, Medicaid, commercial, bad debt, charity, those are all uncompensated care categories. And so you see that the gain and loss without the subsidy is the 1.126586. You can see that under the totals there, where it says gain or loss. And then the subtotal gain or loss after the subsidy and the operations. And so that brings that overall deduction with the subsidy, with that 511,294, then it brings it down to 615,292 for those two service lines, emergency and family medicine. And that's what the subsidy agreement also mentions, and also mentions the uncompensated care from Medicare, Medicaid, and bad debt for all the other service lines in the hospital. So under that line, you'll see all other items, and you'll see the uncompensated care for those three categories. And that would be the total amount for a loss, in this case, after the subsidy, is the $5,526,756. That's just for 6 months. But that total operations, but the two total lines, is really a loss of $615,000. And the conclusions of that, as we've been back and forth on how to say this, but basically the healthcare subsidies that are covered under charitable services, emergency department and family practice, physician services, are estimated at that 6 months loss without the subsidy, and with the estimated tax subsidy of $511,284, that loss is reduced to the $5,526,756. But then when you take the total Peace Health services provided for the same period, it resulted in a positive margin of $89,930. So that's not red, but that's black for all hospital operations overall. But that's not a huge margin. It's a 0.79% with the subsidy. That's a margin with the subsidy. And a negative margin of 4.05% without the subsidy. So the subsidy matters to the overall operations. And I just add this last piece here because that's just part of, you know, you guys know what that is, the subsidy agreement. But that's just what spells out those two service lines. Any questions about the financial report?
Yeah, I've got one about it. What is filling that $5.5 million gap? I guess, because it's a negative $5.5 million without the other services, I guess, that are bringing in a pretty significant profit, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Lab, x-ray, all the other service lines that are in the hospital, inpatient, all the other service lines, oncology, everything that you see on that top, that front page.
What's the biggest moneymaker for the hospital?
Well, I'd say right now it's probably lab and x-ray and maybe even oncology. Then that's because of the, you know, the reimbursement and the just the cost of the meds. I mean, oncology is not an inexpensive thing. And lab and x-ray is, you know, surgeries. But primary care and emergency care, not so much. I mean, we've got a lot of, we don't necessarily have a lot of Medicaid, but it's growing. A lot of Medicare. So those are deductibles and uncompensated care for what isn't covered. You know, you contract for those services and you contract to accept whatever that is, no matter what's charged, and write off the difference. That's why you are surveyed every year. So to make sure that you can still do business with Medicare and Medicaid.
What's a system fee?
System fee? Well, there's a system fee for the services that are managed from Bellingham, like imaging, lab, all those things, because we're a spoke of a hub. So the system fee comes from Peace Health for things like HR, payroll, benefits, all those things, and all those different other services that they provide. Billing and electronic medical record and all of that, which is provided by the hospital system overall.
So when you have a loss under Medicare, is that the difference between what Medicare pays you and what you actually charge for the services?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So you have a procedure and you say that procedure is worth $1,000 and Medicare says nope, it's worth $600, and so you have a $400 negative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Does Medicaid and Medicare cover the x-rays and all those other things that make money for the hospital?
Does it cover the cost?
It doesn't ever cover either. So
no.
This is just the emergency and family practice loss,
just
Medicare, Medicaid.
This is just,
there's
yeah.
losses in other areas.
Oh, there's losses, yeah. These are the other losses down here. Of all those other
services.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The 89,000 you said you're out of the red in this. I'm trying to remember the last few years. And
that's not as good as in the past.
Right. I was thinking that was better before.
Yeah, it has been better before.
Is that because reimbursements are declining? Or?
There's a lot of things. Yeah, reimbursements are just declining. There could be other situations come up. I'm not sure with this mix of services just what generally it is, but you'd have to look at some of the trending on whether the volumes are up or down. But yeah, there was a loss in reimbursement from Medicare and different things that come up. But yeah, I think we do, whenever I watch the financials that are given to the board, I think we do the best we can with staffing expense. We're pretty good there. It's expensive to provide services sometimes out here with the other things that are happening, like just transport of stuff, you know, a lot of things that we do out here. Some things are a savings, but not always. Staffing is really our biggest expense. But we, you know, in order to stay open, you gotta have staff. And that's expensive, and so
it's an island,
and you don't make it up with volume, so that's the issue.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting information, because the volume went up significantly in 2019, but it sounds like a lot of that volume is meeting higher need economically.
Yeah, exactly. If you do that, if you there's some use of the emergency department, there's some overuse of that, there's some, you know, things that we need to do better in educating people. I think we could probably have more services in the clinic, and this is one of the things we're doing with this integrated behavioral health, is to try to maybe come up with a service line for behavioral health, because we've been doing a lot of that and haven't really been charging in that arena, and that's something that we need to set up and start doing, because that turns out to be a lot of business right now.
Yeah, Medicaid, it's only going to grow with older people.
I know. It's just going to get bigger and bigger. Any questions that come up, don't hesitate to call me. I'll find out for you. I'll get you those surveys, and I'll have Jenny put something together for me. And I really thank you for concentrating on the long-term care initiative, because we know that that's something that we'll all be working with in the future. And I know Peace Health wants to be a part of that, too, but you guys are really going to be driving that one. I'm glad for it, too.
I'm excited about that.
So I'm glad.
Yeah. Thank you, Beth. Does anyone else have anything to ask? Questions? Good.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you.
And Nathan, these reports that Beth gave us today are on our website, or will be on our website.
Yeah, they already are.
They already are. Okay.
The PowerPoints
okay,
are there.
Perfect.
Thank you, Beth.
And since we moved Beth up, should we go ahead and vote to approve the funds that we give Peace Health? And so that amount of the subsidy at this time would be $500,011.294 sent to Peace Health for the subsidy agreement for June through September of 2019.
Was that a motion?
Yes.
I'm entertaining a motion.
Yes. I move that we approve the
You can just say the amount due. You don't have to say the number if you want.
Okay. Okay.
It's
so 511,294 to Peace Island, Peace Health.
A second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. And since we're moving backwards,